It is my pleasure to introduce our main speaker, Mike, from Las Vegas.
Hi, everybody. I'm Mike. I'm an alcoholic. No speaker expenses tonight. I was free. I came all the way from Durango and Charleston. And I need to make a disclaimer. I'm not a circuit speaker. That'll probably be painfully obvious by the end of the meeting. I'd like to thank Bob. Bob asked me to speak, and then he went to Copenhagen, so that tells you, you know. I'm grateful to be here. I'd be just as honored if I got to ask to stack chairs. I really would. I that's the real important stuff to me. When I was early sober, I was in just the first couple of meetings, and they said, we need your help. Why don't you help us get into service and help us wash these ashtrays and coffee cups? That's back when I got sober, you know. And you have to wash the coffee cups first. If you do it the other way around, the coffee tastes like ashtray the next time. And here I was washing those, and about a minute and 10 seconds later, of course, I had a resentment because I was seeing all those people chit-chatting, and I never even drank out any of those coffee cups that I was washing, you know, but that's the kind of alcoholic I am. You know, I was born, actually a long time ago, my sponsor says. I didn't think it was that long ago, but I was born in 1958. You know, I have some pretty important dates to me. I was born in 58. I got sober in 1982, December the 2nd of 1982. This coming May 5th will be my first date with my wife. That's a big day. We celebrate that every year, our first date. She kept chasing me around, and I finally, you know, broke down. And it was almost like that because I'd dated newcomers before and kind of had some bad experiences, so I didn't date any newcomers for a long time. But I got to be honest with you, she didn't have much time when we started dating. And we took it real slow. I want to say welcome to the newcomers. I'd like to especially speak to the newcomers to start with. If you're here and you're not sure you belong here, just hang around. I wasn't sure I belong here. And that was over 24 years ago. You know, if you're angry 1 minute and scared the next, hang around. That was me when I got here. You know, if you don't belong here and you hang around here anyway, it really doesn't hurt you. You know, later on, if you decide you can drink and go back out there and you happen to be non-alcoholic, you know, like the book says, our hats are off to you. But if you are alcoholic, I'm really glad you're here. If you think that we're crazy and a lot of the stuff we say is just, you know, the same old rhetoric, you know, boring and all that stuff, you know, hang around. When I came in here, I really thought you guys had I thought you were just like puppets. You just said the same thing. You said the same thing over and over. Now I know why. Because, you know, when I'm sober, I forget real easily, you know, and I've had to hear the same thing. I've literally, you know, I've sat in over 10,000 AA meetings. And some days I still need to be in a meeting to hear the same thing again. And I've probably heard it 10,000 times. I don't know how many times I've heard chapter 5 read. And some days something will pop that I have never heard in 10,000 times I've heard chapter 5. So if you're a newcomer, you know, we're grateful you're here. And just hang around no matter what. Whether you think we're crazy, whether you feel like maybe you don't belong here, it's really okay. Just hang out anyway. When I was, talk about my childhood just a minute, and I hate to talk about my childhood. I won't say hate, that's a pretty strong word, but I had a miserable childhood. I really did. And you know, it's not my favorite topic, but I know some other people did. My childhood did not make me alcoholic, I'll tell you that right up front. It did make me very angry, it made me very resentful. I had a really miserable childhood. I was the first child into my family. My father was a big man. He was 6'2", 230 pounds, and he was very, very abusive. And my mother never did anything about it except yell and scream, and that actually didn't solve anything. That usually just made it worse. And, you know, I have memories of being 4 years old and being popped in the face and having my nose bloodied at 4 years old. And you know, we had a lot of, that's just what went down when my father wasn't beating on the kids. He and my mom were going at it. And, you know, I talked to some of my friends that went through, that went to Vietnam. I kind of relate to some of the crap they went through. That was like living in my childhood. You know, you were always on edge. You were always afraid of something bad happening. And anyway, that was my childhood. Didn't make me an alcoholic, but I can tell you, I resented that man so badly. And I have to tell you that because, you know, later on, I've had to make amends to that man. I can tell you that I developed rage. You know, I used to, when he was done whooping on me sometimes, I used to stand there and say, you know, someday I'll kill you. You beat on me when I'm young, but someday I'll grow up and I'll kill you. I used to say that to him, and I'd be very angry. I was a very good student. For me, going to school was a relief. I love going to school. That was like, to get out of my home and go to school was like a treat. And, you know, I go to school, and I mean, you know, the kids in class sometimes thought the teachers were mean. They'd never been to my house. I thought the teachers were just all sweethearts, you know. They ask you to do something, you do it, and you don't get in trouble. No big deal, you know. And I was a great student. I loved to go to school, and I was an overachiever most of the time in school. And, you know, I would go home, and I'd do my homework, and I'd come back. And but at some point, you know, I got my resentment took over. I was always this really nice kid who hung out, you know, with the straight-A students, and then at some point, right around 12 years old, I kind of got hooked up with the wrong kids, and I kind of just broke out all that stuff I'd been doing, and I was still a good student, but I learned to drink, and I got to tell you, the first couple times I drank, it wasn't any fun. I mean, when I first started drinking, we had shag carpet. That's how long ago. When I, you know, and I mean really long stuff. They sold you shag carpet, and then they sold you a rake, you know, to rake it back up. All the old people are nodding their heads, and the kids don't know what I'm talking about. But I would come home drunk and put my fingers through that carpet and hang on because it felt like I was going to fall off the floor. Obviously, I couldn't, but that's what it felt like when the room would spin, you know. And, but I got over not drinking correctly. And I hooked in and got it dialed in, and I felt magic when I drank. You know, it did something for me that I found I really understood. You know, my perception was that my problems before that point had always been not any alcohol. That was really my problem. I saw it that way. I said, you know what? I have found my solution. This is why I don't feel good. I never had alcohol. Now that I found alcohol, I don't ever want to be without it. That's just what went through my mind. I learned to drink well. I learned to drink an awful lot. I first drank lots and lots of beer, and of course I did all that stuff, all those other drugs that we had a lot of drugs back in those days, but that's, you know, I'm not going to talk a whole lot about that, but that's what we did. And I can tell you, we used to, you know, when you're, now back where I got, where I learned to drink, you could drive at 14. That seems crazy to me today, but you could drive at 14. I had a car at 14, and we would pull up beside beer trucks. One guy would throw the door open, the other guys would pull the cases through the window, and we would dash off, and we'd go hide them somewhere. That's how we got our beer in the early days. And when we couldn't do it that way, we went up to Circle K, we found some deadbeat, you know, going into Circle K, and we'd pull him aside and bribe him. And of course, you got whatever he liked, you know, when he came back out. And we would be around the side of the Circle K or 7-Eleven, right? And every once in a while, those guys would go around the other way. So we got smarter, and we had a guy planted on the other side because they used to do that. We give them the money, they go in the door. Instead of coming around the side where they knew we were, they go around the other side. So we'd wait over there too. We covered both sides of the Circle K and 7-Eleven. And still, though, you know, that drinking all that beer and that wine just wasn't my cup of tea. I learned to drink Bacardi 151, and that was really what hit home with me. And people would see me, and I had a reputation for that Bacardi 151. I straight shot at it, coke back, and I was really good at it, and it got me where I wanted to go really, really quick. And, you know, I'm a blackout drinker. I'm a blackout driver. I seriously used to say all the time, you know, people would say, are you okay? I go, well, look, I'm really, really drunk. You know, if I, you know, I can't walk, but I can drive. I say it all the time. you just get me to my car, I'll be all right. And I really did believe that. And I drove all the time. Now you got to remember, I drank in a little town. You know, if I drank and drove like that in Vegas, I probably would have died a million times. When I listen to Tom Ivester, I get chills because I know I probably would have run over and killed people, you know. And I mean, I seriously used to come to, and the only reason I stopped was because the car had run out of gas in my blackout, you know. I seriously did. I would just be along the road somewhere, and and I'd look down, and the gas gauge was empty, and I didn't know where I was. And, you know, I had a problem with remembering which side of the road to drive on. Seriously, this used to happen to me. I used to get all blacked out and forget, you know, which side you're supposed to be on. So sometimes I would just get back on the road and drive anyway. And, you know, every once in a while, people would tell me by honking their horn and flashing their lights at me that I was on the wrong side of the road. I went down the wrong side of an interstate more than once, you know. Went right through those do not enter signs, I guess. I don't remember. I drove off the top of an overpass one time. I cranked it to the right on the top of an overpass and went off the top and totaled out a car. You know, that's some pretty wild drinking days. But you know what? Even though all those things would happen, they didn't seem bad at all. That was a pretty small trade-off, you know, for the way it made me feel. I had never felt that good in my life as when I drank and I used drugs. And I did that for a long, long time. And my drinking career started out where I had nice cars, nice clothes. I mean, I'm serious. When I was 17 years old, I drove a Jaguar XKE, I had a Thunderbird, and I had a new truck. Okay, I made a lot of money. What I forgot to tell you was I really liked school, but I dropped out because I got a good job setting steel. So I went to work with these crazy guys on the steel crew. I'm going into bars at 15 years old, you know, and the drinking age was only 19, so I pulled it off. And, you know, I go in, I'm dressed nicely, and you know, and I've got a lot of money and, you know, stuff like that for a young guy. And it went all downhill from there, but I didn't really notice it. You know, it kind of moves slowly. If you're an alcoholic like I am, you know, things start changing, but they change so slowly that you really don't notice. And at about the age of, by 18, I started my own company. I was working for the steel crew, and I decided to go out on my own, start my own company, you know. And I did that, and I had some success right off the bat. And I did really well. I made way more money than I should have for a young guy. And what happened was the more money I made, the more I partied, you know, and the worse it got. And in my 20s, I was probably about 22, 23, and I met this gal, and she was a sober alcoholic, and it absolutely blew my mind. I had no idea why anyone would not drink. I really didn't get it. I remember sitting in the bar. My thinking used to be like this. When people would walk into a bar and they look like social drinkers, I just didn't like them. You know, I really didn't get them. I just like, you know, just get out of here. You know, you just, you know, you kind of people, you know, bore me. I don't get you. You know, just leave. And, you know, in the meantime, I'd gotten worse and worse and worse. And somehow this gal and I, first of all, she would drop me off at the bar and then go to the AA meeting down the way. And that's the kind of relationship we had for a while. It was, you know, yeah. And, you know, a lot of people were starting to wonder about my drinking. They would, you know, wonder out loud to me. They'd say things like, you know, you sure spend a lot of time in the bar these days. Are you okay? And I'm going, of course I'm okay. What do you mean? Sit down, shut up, drink. You know, I mean, I'll buy you, you know, whatever you want to drink. And, you know, at the end I wasn't offering anything because I didn't have any money. And there was this one night, this gal that I can't remember if I was dating her at the time or married to her, and she comes home and she says, do you think you might be alcoholic? She says, Beverly thinks you might be alcoholic. And I said, who in the heck is Beverly? You know, I said it a lot worse than that. And she goes, well, Beverly's this gal I go to meetings with. And I'm like, F Beverly and the horse she rode in on, you know? So I knew some of these people from outside the meeting, and I saw this old broad get into this light blue Cherokee, and I knew that was Beverly, right? You know, and I hated Beverly. You know, I had an instant resentment because she had been telling this gal that I was alcoholic, and I would see her. This is no kidding. It's a small town. I'd see Beverly go down the road, and I would scowl at her. You know, and I was still driving at the time. I wanted to swerve at her. You know, I'd see that. You know, Beverly didn't have a clue, right? I got sober, and I've been resenting the wrong woman for 2 years because, you know, Beverly drove a Thunderbird, and this old gal's name was Patsy, and Patsy was just a dear. I mean, this woman, I had put more resentment down on her, and she was the sweetest gal. She loved to laugh. She'd been sober about 4 years when I got sober, and I told her this story, and she just laughed her head off. She thought it was funny, and I can tell you, one of my earliest meetings, this little old gentleman walked up to me, and he introduced himself, and he said his name was Joe Clements, and he looked like a leprechaun to me. He spoke like a leprechaun. He was short, and everybody really paid him a lot of positive attention. He'd been sober a lot of years. At the time, I think he was sober like 38 when I first met him, 38 years. And I heard stories about this little leprechaun guy, like, oh, Joe and Clancy have been going to Russia, and they're trying to take AA to Russia, and there's a whole lot of drunks over there, but the Russians try to hide it all and all this. That's what I would hear about Joe. And Joe got my phone number. I don't know how I still had a phone number. I really don't. It was kind of a fluke. I didn't have a car anymore, you know. I lived in an old lady's garage. I literally had a converted garage I lived in, and by the end of my drinking, you know, I told you I went to the nice bars and I dressed up nicely and that sort of thing. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had 3 dirty shirts, 2 pairs of dirty pants, and, you know, I didn't shower much anymore. I mean, I was starting to get a little bit ripe, but this is what happened. I would have showered more, but I didn't like the way that, you know, when you drink too much and drug too much, your nerves get kind of frazzled, and the feeling of water on me just didn't feel right anymore. I got tired of it. You know, I like to drink a lot, but I don't like the water on me anymore. It just irritated me, you know, and I'm not exaggerating at all. I mean, so this little gentleman named Joe somehow he asked me for my phone number, and I guess he made himself my sponsor because he called me the next morning. Joe didn't even live where I got sober. He lived 80 miles away, but he was like this little guru who was always racing around fixing AA wherever he went, and he would call me. Now, when I stop drinking, I can't sleep. I am absolutely wired. I mean, I am, you know, here I am at 1 o'clock. 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, and I remember 5 o'clock. That's the last thing I remember. That's in the morning, you know, and then the phone would ring at 7 a.m., and it'd be, top of the morning to you, Mulligan, how are you? You know, and I'd just be going, well, I just barely got to sleep. You know, that's how I am. You know, I'm irritable, restless, and discontent, but I didn't know it at the time. You know, I didn't know that's what you called it. And he would say, what meeting did you go to last night? And I'd say, oh, I went to the 8 o'clock meeting, you know, da, da, da. And Joe was phenomenal. Joe, I met so many people that he would do the same thing to, that he took a personal interest in those people. You know, he was an amazing guy. He would get their phone number, and he would call them. He didn't wait for us to get around. And Joe gave me tons of direction in early sobriety. And you know what? If I'd had a couple of drinks sometimes when he was giving me this direction, I probably would have poked him. I really would have. Because he used to sit there and tap me on the chest very lightly and tell me what to do. You know, he was about that tall. And, you know, and I didn't know what to do. You know, sober, I'd talk back to him if I'd been drinking, but sober, I was so out of it, I just, I would listen. I actually ended up in a couple of Al-Anon meetings by accident, too, when I got sober, because they have them in the same club sometime, you know, and those ladies, like, shipped me out of there so quick, it was ridiculous. I mean, I barely made it through the front door, and they, you know, I guess they don't like alcoholics hanging around when they're talking about us or something, because they would get out of there. They would get me out of there and ship me over. Oh, you're in the wrong meeting. You need to be over there. And I actually kind of liked listening to them rant and rave. It's what it sounded like to me. You know, when I was early sober, I was lost. Absolutely lost. I hadn't done anything sober before. I mean, I'm a guy who never tried to stop drinking. I hear a lot of people said they were projectile vomiters. That's not me. I try to keep my booze down. You know, I try really hard to keep it down. You know, you vomit, you got to start all over again. You know, you know. And if you don't have much money like I didn't, you know, it's too expensive to do that. I hear a lot of people say that they tried to stop drinking a million times. I tried to keep drinking every single day. I'm a guy who gets up in the morning, and I learned early on that rum, that 151, goes down a lot smoother if it's in the freezer. You know, if you keep it below freezing, you know, of course it obviously doesn't freeze, but you pull it down first thing in the morning, it goes down real sweet, no problem at all. And here I am, 24 years old, that's the way I drank. I pulled it out in the morning. I got to tell you, I despised those hours in each day that I had to be somewhat sober. I really didn't like it, but you know, here I am, I have a crane business, and you got to be a little bit sober part of the day. I mean, this is a real deal. I started my own crane business at 18 years old because I'd learned to run a crane on the steel crew. So I got this big old crane that I've leased, and you know, and I go around and ask you first if you're building a house or an apartment building or whatever, if you're going to need some crane work, and then I'd come back there with the crane lumbering down the road, and then I'm going to pick all this stuff up and swing it across your heads, you know, while you're up on a little wall hanging on for your dear life as it is, I was probably better off some days with a little bit drunk than if I'd been shaky. You know, hungover, I was a worse crane operator than when I was just a little bit drunk. I need to take the edge off just a little bit. I always wonder, looking back, how many people actually smelled my breath when I rolled in. You know, I'd made a lot of money doing that sort of thing, but until the end, because it was really hard to get me to work. You know, I mean, everybody knew where to find me. My marketing was at the casino bar and grill. I just hung out there, right? And that's where the guys would come find me, and they'd say, "Hey, Mike, we could really use your services, you know, later today." And I go, "How about tomorrow? You know, because I'm already drunk. You know, how about tomorrow morning at like 10 a.m.? You know, I worked sometimes from 10 to 2. That was kind of like my day. No, really, that's all I could handle. So after I'm sober for a while, you know, I'm totally lost. I used to have this thing that when I was early sober, I could not speak. I would just choke on my words. So I had to learn this little trick. I had to start breathing out before I started every sentence. Somebody would say something to me, and I'd start to breathe out, and then I could follow it with a word, because I was very anxious. I had a lot of anxiety in early sobriety. I mean, this goes along with not sleeping and, you know, all the other good stuff. Once I started driving again, now, by the way, I had this beat up old alcoholic truck. It was over at the mechanic shop. I didn't have the money to fix it, but slowly but surely I walked to meetings, saved some money. The guy, you know, gave me some credit, put my truck back on the road, and then I had sober blackouts. I would drive the truck like I'd be 30 miles in the wrong direction, stone cold sober, not know why I was there, you know, in early sobriety. And so if you've had those, you know, it's okay. You recover someday from all that stuff. I got to tell you, early sobriety, I thought was, I'm the kind of guy that when I was drinking, I would try to convince people around me. I used to tell them this. I used to sit there and say to them, I said, "Listen, I have a different chemistry than some people. Now, I'm not like those alcoholics out in the gutter. I'm not like those people. Alcohol's bad for them. But for me, alcohol is really good. I mean, it's just like when I do alcohol, it just makes everything right. I mean, I can't hardly talk without alcohol, but I drink and I'm okay, you know. My timing's just completely off, but then when I drink, it's all okay, you know. And I kind of pictured it like all of you guys had little two-way radios, you know, and I had mine, and mine would never work, you know. And then I drink alcohol, and it was just like setting mine to the right channel, and everything was good, you know. And that's kind of the way I felt sometimes. I didn't know that I was describing that I had alcoholism is what I was really telling people. I'm not one of those people. You hear a lot of times, you hear these people say that, you know, my worst day sober is better than my best day drunk. My worst day sober is better than my best day drunk. And that's not my case at all. I had some really, really good days drunk, but I got to be honest with you, at the end, they weren't so good anymore. They really weren't. Well, by the way, that woman, I was married to her at some point. I remember getting married. It was a disaster, I'm telling you. It was a disaster. She had these really highfalutin mom and dad, and he was a dean of a college, you know, and this gal was a debutante, and she had, you know, been to a finishing school, and they threw this beautiful reception, and my drunk friends came and took advantage of the whole thing. And I mean, it was, looking back, after I got sober, I had to do a lot of amends work in that situation. And anyway, at some point she left. And I was actually glad she did, you know, because she had been in my way a lot. You know, she was, you know, all that, you know, feed me and I don't like to eat anymore, you know. And, you know, I accused her of making me fat. And what I really was bloated, you know. I really was. you know, but I used to, you know, here she is from Stevens Finishing School, you know, she's a great chef, and she puts all the beautiful stuff in front of me, and I'm going, you know, and I'm pushing away, going, God, you're making me fat. She goes, well, I'm not fat, and I eat a lot more than you do, you know, because I was getting all my calories through my booze. And anyway, after I got sober, you know, Joe's calling me almost every day, and he's giving me direction nonstop. Do this, do that, do this, do that. And, you know, I don't know how. When I first came to AA, I didn't like it. I heard a crazy guy named Cap. And I liked Cap because he was nuts. I really understood Cap. I really did. This guy was nuts. I heard his story. What happened to him is he lived behind one of those 7-Elevens, and he'd gotten mad because the coolers on top make a lot of noise, you know, and they irritated him. So he got out his hunting bow and arrows, and he shot them. He shot them all. They put him in jail. They fined him $15,000 because, you know, everything soured or whatever in the coolers and all this, you know. And Cap was mad. You know, he thought he was treated unfairly, and I agreed. You know, I would have blamed those stupid coolers, and I'd have shot him too, you know. So I really like Cap, and so, you know, one day I kind of like saying something to him, and I said, what about this God stuff? I don't get this God stuff, you know, and he says, you know, I don't either. He says, they tell me my head is out to get me. He says, I'm trying to believe that, and he says, I go for walks, and I put my palms up to the sky, and I say, God protect me from myself. And so I left that meeting, and of course I was walking, so God protect me from myself. Just like that, you know. And I wasn't going to come back to another meeting, and I actually did. I don't remember getting to the next meeting after doing that, but I ended up in another meeting, and I kept saying that prayer, and I actually believe that's why I kept ending up in meetings, because I think it was almost like God shut off my puny brain, walked my little butt over to a meeting, sat me down, and then woke me back up, brought me back too, because that's the best I can explain it, because I kept showing up in meetings. I would grumble the whole time. I would have gotten up and left, but I was would have felt embarrassed to get up and leave. You know, Joe was a great inspiration to me. He told me to do all sorts of things, and he showed me. He was always busy doing stuff. Joe was just, you know, doing his little leprechaun thing everywhere, you know, he's just going around. And he would always have me, he'd say, one of the things I never forgot, he would say, you know, you need to get those young people involved in doing things. He says, young people have a hard time staying sober, and you're a young guy, and you know how hard it is, so you guys need to do things. He says, whether you guys go out and dance at night as a group, be careful. You know, if you go out early, leave early, but go have some fun. He said, go out together and do this and do that, but get them organized, do some stuff. And he was right. You know, when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was by far the youngest person in that meeting. I was 24 years old, and the next youngest person was 39, you know, and I felt like I was totally out of place. You know, I just didn't get it. Now 39 seems pretty young, of course, when I'm 49, but, you know, I got to tell you that 2 weeks after I was there, a guy named Nick walked in, and Nick was young, and he was hip, slick, and cool, and he was my age, and he had just been out skating for Disney or something, and the reason he came back in, he had some sobriety, but he lost it because he was helping one of our mutual friends use up the last of his dope, and he thought that's how he'd get him into the program. But anyway, that's how he lost his sobriety. I mean, and he swears to this day he did that innocently. You know, we have pretty nutty heads. People. I really appreciate the very first people that were in the meetings where I got sober. They helped me with a lot of disciplinary stuff. You know, I was very undisciplined. I never liked to do anything I didn't want to do. I just, you know, I hadn't done for a long time. Joe was on me right off the bat, and Joe's things were, you know, make your bed every morning. You know, I'm like, you know, ridiculous. Who cares about making a frickin' bed? You know, I've got a sleeping bag on top of mattress, you know. I mean, what kind of making a bed? What's that? You know, he said, well, straighten that sleeping bag out nicely, you know. I mean, I'm like, okay. You know, he said, park away from the front door of every establishment so little old people and women with children have easy access and easy egress. And I'm going, got you there. I don't drive. I don't have a car. He goes, when you get a car, that's what you need to do. Okay. When your car runs again. He told me to pick up a couple of pieces of garbage every day that I didn't throw down. And I'm like, you know, am I going to AA or, you know, trash collectors? What's going on here, you know? And he said, you know, you need to learn to give back to society. You've just been a taker for way too long. And he told me things like, he says, my job is to try to turn you back into the gentleman that I believe God intended you to be. And I wasn't so sure that that would ever happen, nor did I ever want it to ever happen. I kind of enjoyed being kind of ruthless and just kind of obnoxious, you know. I had a curfew when I was drinking. You know, I had a chief of police that pulled me in and put a curfew on me. And even though it was illegal, he said I'd better mind it. And, of course, I just slipped around him all the time. Joe said a lot of things. About a month after I'd been sober and Joe had been telling me to make my bed right, he said, yeah, you've been making your bed every morning, right? I go, yeah, yeah. He goes, you're washing your dishes every day, right? I go, no, I've been washing my dishes. You know, and he says, well, like, when did you last wash your dishes? I said, I don't know, before I got sober. It was quite a while before I got sober. And this is the truth. You know, I had a sink full of nasty old dishes, been sitting in there for a long time, you know. I just didn't get it. I had to be told most of everything in early sobriety. You know, I had a really hard time with the first step. I wasn't sure I was alcoholic. I mean, I fought with that all the time. When I was early sober, I would have rather been nuts. You know, I'm just mentally insane, and I'm okay with being mentally insane. I just don't want to be alcoholic, you know. You know, mentally insane people, they still get to drink, and they give them drugs, you know, if you find the right clinic and so forth. And I mean, you know, if you're alcoholic, you got to give up your booze completely, and that scared the heck out of me. And everybody kept talking about doing it just one day at a time, just one day at a time. And my head kept going, but, you know, what if? If I'm not drinking, I'll never be able to do this, and da-da-da-da-da. And I was right. A lot of that stuff I never would be able to do, again, if I were not drinking. And people in early sobriety did their job. They carried the message to me. I'll never forget, I was really, really happy this one night. This old-timer said, Mike, we go down to the Western Cafe afterwards, and we have coffee. Would you like to join us? And I don't even drink coffee, because when I was early sober, coffee used to make me nuts. You know, I'm already so high-strung when I don't drink that when I drink caffeine, I just fly around the room. So I stayed away from caffeine and early sobriety and sugar and everything. And so anyway, I went down with him, and I drank my decaf, and I felt a part of something for a change. And, you know, Joe was really good. He told me about another thing he told me was to save my money. He said, you know, you've screwed up your life for a while. You've screwed up your finances. You know, you need to get back on track, and you need to be careful, you know, and put a little bit of money away, and you'll have a life worth staying sober for, you know. And I'm glad he told me that, and he taught me that. I was able to save back enough money to get, you know, expand my business, and you know, and it really did take off in early sobriety. I had my one company. I actually got it rolling again, and those guys, and then I bought another crane, and got another crane operator, and I got another crane and another crane operator, and then pretty soon I got a third crane operator, and I didn't have to do it anymore. And I started a recreation company, and that was kind of cool, because what would happen would be I'd take all the AAs out on my toys, you know, all these ones at the beginning of every season, and I'd let all you test them to make sure they were operating correctly before I let the tourists, but it was really a good deal. Like, we'd take this Christmas tree hunt, and I'd take like 35, 40 AAs out, you know, and we'd go out and we'd just have a great time, you know, and my sponsor, Joe, always said, you know, they're a gift from God, and you need to gift the people, you know, that you've gotten sober with. He got me into lots of service. I was GSR twice. And I got to tell you, being GSR, I had to drive 120 miles down there, and it was like the most grueling thing I could ever think of doing was going to a GSR meeting, because again, it seemed like all they did was fight at GSR meetings, you know. And he said, well, get some your buddies to go with you. They need to go with you. I mean, I had to beg them to go. You know, I had to, like, seriously, I'll buy you lunch, I'll buy you dinner. You know, just please come with me. And sometime after that, you know, I was sober. You know, my early sobriety was kind of good in some ways, and it was kind of nuts in another. And I'll tell you, one of the things I did was I started dating married women. And I'll tell you what happened was, when I first got sober, I was scared to death to talk to women, except these old broads in the AA meeting. I could talk to them okay, because I knew I wasn't going to date them, you know. And I really wasn't very comfortable talking to gals without drinking. I really wasn't. But I got over that in a big way. I kind of went too far the other way again, like I had been when I was drinking. And I got myself in a lot of trouble. And I started dating married women. Now, didn't make me feel really good on the inside, and I did a lot of things to cover it up. And I got to tell you, when I was dating married women, I tried twice as hard to look good on the outside and do the AA stuff and quote the book better, because I knew, and the old timers kept saying, you know, kid, we know what you're doing. You're a phony. You got to stop dating those gals. They got husbands, you know, blah, 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 blah. And it was a very selfish thing for me to do. I know now that when I dated married women, what it was somebody else paid their bills. You know, I had no commitment. You know, they always had to go home at night. I could go do whatever the heck else I wanted to do. And, you know, that was really going on. So I carried that on till about 5 years sober. And it ate at me and it ate at me and ate at me because I just didn't think, I knew it wasn't the way. It wasn't a good example of a good AA member. And finally, I stopped it. And I got to tell you, I knew this would happen. I felt such tremendous relief. I felt like I was the real deal, you know, finally. And, you know, I never had to do that again. I met another gal. Alcoholic, San Francisco, and we got married, and that was another disaster. That was just, that time it was a sober disaster, though. You know, I mean, you know, I can't drink on my own. I can't stay sober on my own, and I can't have relationships without Alcoholics Anonymous. But I wasn't at a place, and so that was my second marriage. And you know, I'll tell you that 1993, Stephanie came along, and she chased me around these AA meetings. This time I'm 10 years sober, and you know, I'm just like, no more women in AA, no more newcomers especially. I've tried that didn't work, you know. And you know, I said, but boy, she sure is cute. And you know, so this is the truth. I used to take her for walks, you know. I'd invite her, we'd go for a walk, and we'd do it. We'd go walk for miles and talk, you know, and that was it. That was a date, and that started on May 5th, 93. And I took her to dinner a couple of times, and we kept it very platonic for a long, long time. And I'm glad we did it that way. It actually, we got to know each other pretty well. And at some point, I decided, you know, I know she didn't have a car, and I had a bunch of them. I really did. I had like a whole bunch, so I gave her a Jeep. You know, I had a Jeep, and I gave her a gas card because it was a real gas hog, too, and I never drove it anyway. And that was a bad deal. She ran over my Harley with it a few, you know. No, serious. It was really, I have her permission to tell you that. But we didn't, if you're in a relationship, if you're an alcoholic and you're in a relationship and you don't do it very well, it's okay. Man, we did it miserably, and we're still here. I cannot believe it. There were all these shiny people, it appeared to us, you know. They were so perfect about their relationships. Their relationships were all so good, and we were pathetic, you know. We fought all the time over everything, and I mean, it just seemed like we hardly had a smooth day for, you know, months at a time. And our friends used to call us War of the Roses, you know, the movie, and you know how the monster truck runs over the stuff in the front yard, and you know, that was us. We fought all the darn time. And what happened was we would constantly try to take direction, and we just hung in there, and we hung in there, and we hung in there. And at some point, we finally just, you know, were able to let go of all that feuding and fighting amongst ourselves. And but it was only through good sponsorship. It really was, you know. Tons of times, you know, I would just, you know, throw up my hands, walk out the door, and call my sponsor. And, you know, he would say things, I've got the same sponsor. I've got Dick Toussaint is my sponsor. I don't think I told you that. And he's a tough old bird, just like Joe C. was. You know, Dick tells me a lot of nutty stuff, it sounds like, at times, you know. One time she had made off with a bunch of money, and I was really angry about it. You know, and I call him, and I'm going on and on and on about it. And he says, okay. And he says, well, tell her, give her $500 more, and tell her, you know, if she needs some more money, they'll give it to her also. And I'm going, you know, obviously, you know, I start telling the story all over again. And he goes, you know, seriously, he says, why are you repeating yourself? I already heard the story. I said, well, obviously, you weren't listening. You know, because the direction you just gave me sounds nuts. And he goes, you know, so I said, okay, I'll do it. So I give her the $500 more, and about a day and a half later, she comes back to me, and she says, you know, I really don't need this $500 and all that other money. Well, here, I cashed that stuff back. Yeah, I traded that stuff back in, and here's the most of the money from that too. You know, and I'm just going like, how did that happen? But all I did was listen to Dick, and he told me what to do. And, you know, we've had lots of situations like that. We'll be somewhere, you know, and we start to get in a bicker. This has happened. We haven't had a good fight in years, but in the old days, we used to, and he used to say things like, you know, have you got a quiet place where you can hit your knees? Yeah. He said, well, I want you to hit your knees, and I want you to ask God to how to be a better husband. I'm going, you don't understand. It's her fault, not mine, you know. And he could do it anyway. Oh, okay. You know, I want you to ask God how to forgive her better, because you're not very good at forgiving her. You know, you'll carry this on for a year. And he was right about that. And, you know, and I would do that kind of stuff. And I mean, that kind of stuff. The only way I'm able to have a relationship, though, is to have a sponsor who's had a relationship, you know, who's in a relationship, who, you know, I've had some sponsors or wannabe sponsors over the years that, you know, that weren't in relationships. They didn't know what to tell me. I had a temporary sponsor here in Las Vegas at one time, and I would go to him and I'd say, I'm losing my mind. I don't know what to do. We're going to kill each other. And he'd say, boy, every time I listen to you or Bob or George, I'm just glad I'm not in a relationship. I go, that's it? You know? Oh, I feel good now. You know? I'm just going to go back and fight with her some more, I guess, you know. But, you know, I started to say the first step was hard for me. I did get past the first step, obviously, and the second and the third. And the third was a little bit rough for me because when I was out there, I kind of said, you know, I did some dastardly things when I was out there. I mean, I was a real jerk. I stole a lot of stuff in blackouts. You know, I didn't steal sober. But, you know, I didn't even know I stole, you know, until I'd be in front of a judge or something. And that happened repeatedly. I'd be in a, and I always felt like a victim, of course, you know, stand in front of a judge, getting punished for stealing when I didn't even remember doing it. I didn't do it consciously, you know. And I would try to, and I would always say the same thing. He'd say, how do you plead? And I'd say, I plead guilty with an explanation, you know. I don't know if they let you do that here, but that's what they used to let me do. So, and he said, okay, what's your explanation this time? You know, I said, well, I really don't remember doing this. I got too drunk or something like that. And he just slammed down his gavel and say the same thing every time, you know. And you know, I can, if you're in and out of the room sometimes, what happened for me was, you know, when I drank, if I missed a night of drinking or something, I just really felt like I was missing out, you know. I mean, I just always had, and that's what happens in, I've been in AA so solidly for so long that if I miss a couple of days AA, I feel the same way. I believe that people in AA need to just get in, get so wet, and get so involved in AA that if you miss out on a little, you feel like you're missing out if you're not here. And that's the way I am. I know that if I miss meetings for just a few days, you know, I just feel like I'm out of my loop. You know, I need to be here. Most of my friends are in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I have a lot of friends outside of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have a lot of friends, but most of my friends are in here. And, you know, I have true friends in here. You know, my drinking friends, they were always fair weather friends. You know, if you had something to give to them, and, you know, but if you needed help and nothing to give to them, you didn't get any help. You know, in AA, people are happy to help you, and they usually don't expect much in return. You know, I absolutely, you know, I thank God with every fiber of my body. I thank the people in Alcoholics Anonymous that have helped me along the way, because I just, you know, I don't know how to have relationships. I don't know how to stay sober. I have no idea how to do much of this stuff. My father that I mentioned kind of disappeared. He drank an awful lot about the time I got sober. He disappeared. We didn't know where he went, and I didn't care. Quite frankly, I couldn't care if he'd been run over by a car at that point. I never heard from him for 17 years, and I didn't miss him one second of that 17 years. But he called, and I was sober by that time, and, you know, a long time by then, and I started talking to him, and I didn't see him for 22 years. I didn't see my father for 22 years. But now my father and I talk almost every week. He has a cell phone. It's kind of pathetic, and it's sad, and it kind of yanks at my heart. But, you know, he was a man who, we had everything when I was a kid. I had go-karts and motorcycles and stuff. We were totally abused all the time physically, but we had a lot of great stuff. And, you know, he made good money. And today he lives in the Arizona desert in a little bitty travel trailer. I mean, it's really sad. He's 73 years old and he still drinks, and it's hard to see. But my wife and I go over to see him from time to time, and I talk to him on the phone. And you know, the reason that I do this, and he calls up and borrows money, or I give him money. And the reason, if I don't do that, that means I'm not willing to forgive. So the reason I do it is an effort to be proactive in the forgiveness, because that whole forgiveness thing is not about him. You know, I don't know if it makes him any better, but it does make me a lot better. And you know, today, you know, I give him to God, you know, and you know, he calls, and sometimes he's really drunk and he says some really bizarre stuff, and God bless him, you know. And I, every once in a while, I, you know, say, well, you know, AA's sure been working good for me all these years, you know. Maybe you ought to check it out someday. And I've let go of a lot of the anger. I haven't been arrested for a long, long time. I'm not one of those people that you hear a lot of people say, I stopped drinking and I stopped going to jail. I didn't do that, you know. I stopped drinking, kept going to jail for a while because I got in fisticuffs at intersections, you know, because I had the right of way and then he flipped me off, you know. Yeah, and they still take you to jail anyway. So, I'm going to wrap it up here because, you know, I'm just really grateful to have the opportunity to be here, to be sober. You know, I have a life better than most people that I know that never drank like I did, who never caused as much destruction as I did. And I know a lot of people in this program that it just makes me glow to watch them. I know a lot of people, how they came in here, because I've been here a long time, and I got to see them come in. And I know what Craig was like when he got here. I didn't see him then, but I've seen pictures, you know, I with the afro. And, you know, and I've seen Bob looked like I used to look, with long, curly, you know, big beard, the whole weird looking, you know, just down and out stuff. And, you know, I hang with a lot of, you know, I still hang with the winners. They told me a long time ago to do that, you know. See people in Alcoholics Anonymous that have what you want. Those are your winners, and hang with them. And for that, I'm grateful, and thank you for listening. Thank you.